Listening to Weekend Let's Hear It in WMUK's Takeda Studio. I'm Craig Freeman, and that was Dan Willenberg playing Monk's tune Vaya. And I now know where Super Mario gets its feel from.
I love it.
I couldn't help but hear that. hearing that groove being present no matter what you were doing rhythmically was impressive in and of itself.
Oh man, well thank you, it's
a cool tune. That also kind of brought to mind, because there are lots of these moments of these sparse accented chords that you were playing, and it reminded me of when I hear a Monk tune, his comping style sometimes is really harsh and percussive, and it's sometimes excessively repetitive.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about that for a little bit. Just the way he supports other artists and what makes that unique in and of itself.
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many things about that. The first two things that I'll say about that. Well, the first goes along with what we were just talking about, which is the melody is always present. It's always there. Even when he's comping, He's highlighting the melody that you heard earlier, even though somebody else is playing a totally different melody. You know, you'll hear Coltrane, or you hear Charlie Rouse playing behind him, and or playing in front of him, I should say. But he's back there and he's sticking with the tune. You know, he's making sure that I probably not for the musicians, but probably for the audience. He makes sure that they're still there. You know. Whether or not you know that you're, again, whether or not you know you're there is kind of up to you, but he always would be staying true to the melody of the tune. You know, that was one of the most beautiful things about his comping. And the other thing about his comping that was so, it still fascinates me, and I have no idea how to do this. I'm still trying to work on it. But for example, you know, when we think of like a C major 7 chord, for example, we think of, you know, we think of C, E, G, B. How Monk thought of that is, I mean, as far as I can tell, if you're going to be playing a major 7 chord, a lot of times melodically, the soloist will find a way to use the third or the fifth or the seventh, or, you know, chord tones, right? And so, you know, you'd have like a C major voicing if you're going to be comping or something, and it would sound, you know, maybe a little something like this. And so you have all these notes in here. You have six different notes in here. And what Monk said, or what he did, was say, you know, if he plays all of those notes, then as the soloist plays, those notes aren't as important because you're already hearing them in the piano voicing. So he would just play the root and then the seventh. It was like that. And even though those notes are still inside of a C major 7 chord, I mean, that's like the outline. That's what we call a shell voicing of major 7 chord. But he would just play that. And so then when Coltrane or Charlie Rouse or something, they would play the third, you know, you hear this, and then they would play some line, and all of a sudden they would land. And now you hear that note as if you've never heard it before within that chord. Wow. Even though it's implied the whole time, he would leave stuff out, you know. That's, I think, a big misconception about Monk, is that he would always add to chords. He would always make them bigger and more dissonant. He was actually kind of the opposite of that. He was, he loved taking stuff away and letting it be free to be played or not to be played by whoever's soloing.
Yeah.
You know, and not everybody could stand it. You know, it was, there's like that story of him and Miles when they recorded together. It's just a story though. I mean, Miles disputes it, but whatever. You know, not everybody could kind of appreciate, I think, how Monk comped for his musicians. And you know, what's funny is that sometimes he wouldn't, he would just get up and dance. And that was like one of my favorite things about him, is that if he didn't need to play, he didn't need to play. You know, he was okay with just getting up and doing some kind of weird like dance that he always did, where he would spin around and like move his arm.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
when you saw him doing that, you know, from what I've read, that's when his musicians knew that you were really swinging, that you were sounding good, is when he didn't even play anything. He just wanted to enjoy it, you know?
Wow.
I think we all need a little bit more of that in our lives.
It's such a cool way to look at things with as far as comping is concerned, and starting with, you know, seemingly dissonant interval and hearing it in a new way that you've never heard it before.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So wild.
And then with comping, I guess everyone has their preference for what they'd like. And is it safe to say that Monk kind of just did what he did, and if you didn't like it, that was, he wasn't going to adjust to you?
Well, most of the time you'd be playing in his band, so he would do what he wanted to do, you know, and that's the beauty of it too, is he was a great band leader, and, you know, he was always helpful to whoever he was playing with. If he wanted something, he would kind of let you know that he wanted it without telling you what to do. It was just more of like, he would kind of be a coach for what the music needed, as opposed to, you know, trying to dictate who or what, you know, should play what in his group, if that makes sense. He had a very clear idea of what he wanted, and I think that the musicians that maybe couldn't handle that were maybe somebody like Miles, who also had a very clear idea of what he wanted, you know. But then you get somebody like Coltrane, who, when he started playing with Monk, he was kind of in that period where he was just starting to find out, you know, who he really was as an artist, you know, other than playing in Miles's first group, and being a part of that really tight quintet. You know, he was trying to explore the things that he had not been exposed to, and so Monk kind of took him under his wing, and you know, they would sit in Monk's home and just play his music for hours, and he would never write out a note for Coltrane. He'd always make him play it by ear. That was his whole thing, was if you're going to learn a tune, you got to learn it by ear. And yeah, and I think Coltrane, for example, you know, because he later ended up becoming this visionary, you know, it wasn't after, you know, not long after he was playing with Monk, he kind of stepped into his own category among the gods, you know, and a lot of that I think could be attributed to the clear vision that Monk had for his music. And, you know, especially after Coltrane worked with Miles, when you have people like that to look up to, and you see what it takes to build your, I don't want to say like reputation or your musical voice, you know, when you're trying to put that together, that's what I'm trying to do right now. You know, is I'm trying to figure out who I am as a musician. And so when you have these influences to look up to that were unashamed, you know, and they just went for it. They just did it. And yeah, it's always inspiring to think about that.
I wonder, 'cause as far as I've read, Monk really didn't play too many covers, and he played a lot of his own music. I wonder why do you think that is? Is it related to what we were just talking about? And he just wanted to, he had a clear vision for what he wanted from his music and wanted to show everybody what it was.
So he actually did quite a bit of covers, or standards as you would call them. He's got a, like for example, he's got a record, Monk Plays Ellington, where he does all, Duke Ellington's compositions. And I think that was more of a contractual obligation before he switched recording companies than it was maybe him wanting to do it. But he actually, there's a couple of, you know, standards I think were actually a pretty important part of his repertoire. Believe it or not. And I think that through the standards that he loved to play, he was, you know, when he was kind of up and coming in figuring out who he was, I think the standards kind of provided a vehicle for him to explore inside of. And that's when he really started coming along, you know, with his own voice. And maybe he played fewer standards as he got older because his music was getting more well known at that point. And yeah, standards are a really interesting topic for Monk too, because even when he plays standards, he couldn't help but sound like himself, which is just fascinating, because you take like a beautiful, you know, you take like a beautiful tune called like I Should Care. That was one of, I think, his favorite ones to play. And he would, it sounded like he wrote it, you know, even though it's just this like beautiful, like all these perfect chord changes and everything. He always found a way to just make it sound like it was his tune. And so you'd be listening to it and you'd be like, is that I Should Care? And then you hear the melody, because he's always playing the melody, and you're like, yeah, wow, that's it. It's there. And it's not hidden. It's just not always as recognizable as we're used to hearing standards be played.
Yeah.
You know? So his standards became like his, that was also like his music, you know. It's funny. Yeah. Kind of like how Coltrane did, you know, when he started getting into the whole, as we think of them as Coltrane changes, and he would like rewrite standards using his kind of harmonic ideas. I think Monk kind of was the, you know, one of the predecessors of that too, to do with just like really simple tunes that he would just take in all these crazy places.
I guess that's the power of, you know, having your own voice and your own sound.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're all trying to achieve is, no matter what you do, you're always going to be recognizable. You always have your stamp on things.
Yeah. And I think it's more of a because I mean, I can't, as much as I would love to sit down and play every single note of me, you know, being original and being, you know, as much as I think we all want to do that, I bet if you asked Monk how he thought of himself, he would say that he's a product of what he grew up listening to and what he grew up, you know, the musicians that taught him lessons along the way. And so it's, everything is just passed down. Everything is, you know, it's not to say that anything's not original anymore, but to some extent, I think that we are all just kind of, you know, on the shadows of giants, whether those giants are Bach and Mozart, or whether those giants are, you know, like Louis Armstrong. You know, if we're all kind of going in those, in that direction, but we all listen to different things. We all have different personalities. We all have different values and beliefs in both music and in life. And I think that when you can accept those about yourself, and you can come to terms maybe with some of them, and then you start playing your music, you know, maybe imitating the style of somebody who inspires you, but not doing it to be, you know, just another carbon copy of Monk, for example, because I don't want to be that. I would love to be close to that, but I don't want to be Monk part two. I don't think anybody maybe would, but it's a beautiful process to see, you know, in Monk's early recordings and his late recordings, how much similar they are, but also how much more meaningful they are. Yeah, it's really fascinating to listen to. And fortunately, we have so many recordings of it. You know, I wish that I could hear Beethoven play, but you know, that ain't gonna happen. So I'm just glad that I can go back, you know, and listen to a Monk recording with Coleman Hawkins from 1947, and just be like, wow, that was Monk. You know.
Yeah. It's really cool. Yeah, I think we could hear another tune or two.
Okay.
Is there something else you'd like to play?
Yeah. I'd like to play one that I don't ever really play this one too much, but I think it's kind of fun. It's called Let's Cool One. And I just love that name. I think it's so awesome. Let's Cool One. So here it is. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Let's Hear It. We're here in WMUK's Takeda studio. That was Dan Willenberg with Let's Cool One by Thelonious Monk. And man, that, if there's any tune that like sounds like its name.
Exactly. That's what, yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad I was able to represent that.
No, man, I heard it. That was so cool. Well, no pun intended.
Right. Nice.
And I heard, I think it was from like the Ken Burns, jazz series or something, but Wynton Marsalis talking about Monk, and he framed it in such a cool way. He said, it's picture like the most wise person, you know, the most knowledgeable sage, and he's trapped in like a 5-year-old's body.
Mm.
And it kind of depicts him as this guy that's kind of trapped against his own will, his own will, and this, you know, all of his mental issues and his quirkiness and those things that we talked about before kind of helped him to do what he did, and thankfully he had a vehicle to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know, for a lot of people it was a turnoff, who really never got to appreciate all that he had to offer.
Mm.
Which is a shame. I wondered, what to you, what makes Monk such a lovable and revered character? Because I think everyone has something that they appreciate or take away from him. What would be yours?
So the more that I learn about Monk, the more that I realize that he, like I said a little bit earlier, his love for people and for helping people and being a father, being a friend, being a mentor, being a leader, being a, you know, he cared deeply about relationships with people that he had. And he, you know, in the time when he was, kind of, you know, doing his thing in New York City, you know, there's all these drug problems going around with all these musicians and everything. And for example, Bud Powell, another great bebop pianist, who learned a lot from Monk, you know, one time they were in Monk's car and they got pulled over, and I guess, you know, Bud Powell had a little bit of heroin on him, and he hid it under the seat. And when the cops searched the car, they found it. And so Monk was arrested, and, he did not, you know, he could have just said like, it's not mine. It's, you know, this drug addict, you know, he wouldn't have said that about him. He wouldn't have ever put him in a position like that where he would take the fall, you know, because he knew that it would, he knew that it would be better for him to take the fall than it would for somebody like Bud Powell.
Wow.
And even though, you know, his cabaret card, was revoked after that, it was a pretty significant hit on his career, at a time when he kind of needed it the most. And yet he never backed down from, you know, I don't want to say, you know, ratting on his friend or snitching on his friend, but it was for the sake of Bud's, you know, artistry, that he didn't want him to go to jail for a certain amount of time, you know. And wow. As far as like how especially musicians were treated back then, you know, especially black musicians back then were treated by police, you know, it was the most noble thing I think that Monk could have done at the time. And, you know, he never spoke ill about it. It was an inconvenience in his life, but you know what? He was all about finding a way around it, you know, and just story after story like that, where people would take credit for a tune that he wrote. They would just put their name on the license for it, you know, for the copyright. And now all of a sudden, any royalties that he gets from that tune is split between two people, even though the other person didn't help him at all or didn't do anything, you know. Wow. But he was always cool with that. He never held it against anybody. He was okay with it. Wow. I mean, I'm sure that he wasn't happy about it, but he never let that affect any of his relationships or, you know, he was just, okay, that's what it is now, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. What, what a way to live life.
Oh my
gosh.
Just
exist in that.
Exactly. And that's exactly, that sums up Monk for me, is the way to be a good person and the way to be an artist are synonymous. They should be. You know, we can sit in our practice rooms all day and we can become amazing musicians and amazing pianists or whatever we want to be. But at the end of the day, it's, what are you doing it for? Who are you doing it for? What's the point? And if you love interacting with people, and if you love people's, you know, tendencies, how everybody's a little bit different and everybody's going to take something away from what you have to offer in their own way. You can't force them to do it. You got to let them do it. And when your music starts turning into that, I think that's kind of, if you are that type of person, I think your music has to turn into that, you know? And I hope that mine will, you know, one day, but it's a process, and you can either embrace the process or you can fight the process. You can be angry about the process, but I tend to view the process of growing as a person and as a musician as they're two sides of the same coin, you know?
Yeah. That's a beautiful way to frame things. And, I think a lot of times we forget that as artists, that, you are more than just your music.
That's true.
Your music is what you leave behind, but also who you are is
exactly
left behind. So we can only hope to be remembered in the same vein that Thelonious Monk is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think we can close with one tune.
Okay.
But before we do, I'd like to thank you for coming in today and sharing
music. Oh, this is great.
Us.
Thank you so much for having me. I was really looking forward to this, and so I'm glad we got to do it.
Well, it's great to have you here. I'd also like to thank our sound engineer, Martin Clem. What would you like to close with?
So I'm going to play, speaking of Bud Powell, I'm going to play a tune that Monk wrote. It's a tune that is inside of another tune. So the original tune is by Irving Berlin, and it's called Blue Skies. Many of you probably know that tune, but he wrote this tune as a tribute to Bud Powell, and he calls it In Walked Bud.
You've been listening to Weekend Let's Hear It. We're here in WMUK's Decatur studio, and that was Dan Willenberg. Dan, thanks so much for coming in again, man. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I hope to come back and do this again sometime.
All right, we'll be here.
Awesome.